year it is. Because for me, poetry is a big deal. And what good is it to have your own show if you don't feature stuff that's a big deal to you? Now, I know some of you might be rolling your eyes when you hear the word poetry for various reasons. Maybe poetry sounds dead to you. Ancient dry texts with that cadence.
By the shores of Kichigumi stood the little Hiawatha.
But that doesn't bother me, because for every poet that sounds like that, there's a poet that sounds like this.
Do not go gentle into that good night. Old age should burn and rave at close of day. Rage, rage against the dying of the light.
That's Dylan Thomas. I love that poem. Or maybe you're a little worn out from the performance poetry you've heard.
There are trees floating in the breeze. I see bees bending their knees.
And that doesn't bother me either, because for every poet like that, there's a poet like this.
When a bullet enters the brain, the head explodes. I can think of no softer warning for the young mothers who sit doubled before my desk, knotting their smooth brown hands and begging, "Fix my boy! Fix my boy!"
That is Patricia Smith, amazing poet. If you don't know her, go find her work right now. Google her, Patricia Smith. Poetry has been a big part of my life for a long time. In fact, without poetry, I doubt I'd be talking to you today. See, I got my start slinging poems in little coffee shops and bars across the country, and it was there that I learned the importance of community and what the power of a good poem can do. You know, hearing Sekou Sundiata for the first time, it changed my life.
Two times peace. From whence I come, from whence we come, from whence I come, from whence we come, that dark woman of a land only knows so well.
But I don't think that I understood that poems and poetry could affect other people until I started competing in poetry slams across the country. If you don't know what a poetry slam is, it's when poets compete against each other.
Welcome to the Poetry Slam. Here's how it works. Poets, you have 3 minutes to perform one original poem of your own construction. Each poem will be scored on a scale of 0.0 to 10.0 by our panel of five judges who have been selected from the audience. All right, enough of my yakking. Let's boogie.
So it's the late 90s, early 2000s, and I'm traveling around the country, competing, writing, meeting people. It was a great time in my life where I was learning a lot and becoming the man that I wanted to be. So one year I ended up at the Southern Fried Poetry Slam in Americus, Georgia. Now, I should say that Americus at the time was a sleepy southern town. I haven't been back to Americus in over 15 years, so I don't know what it's like now, but I can tell you back then, having a large group of poets of all different shapes, sizes, ethnicities, sexual orientations from all over the South, from all over the country, was not something this little town was ready for. I mean, most of the people were great, but we got a lot of strange looks. Now, all the poets stayed in the same hotel. This was a 3-day event, and when we weren't performing, we were doing what poets do when they gather. Partying. Don't laugh, but there is no party like a poet's party, especially slam poets. Painters, sculptors, dancers, hell, rock stars. They are tame in comparison to poets and storytellers. So, in the midst of all this, it was time for a beer run, and I volunteered to go. A couple people went with me, two ladies. They were a couple. One of them had blue-dyed hair with piercings. The other had tattoos all over her. Another poet came. He was Latino. And then there was me, African-American, with baby dreadlocks that admittedly looked like little black snakes sticking out from my head. All this to say, we were not your average customers coming into the small convenience store in Americus, Georgia. And when we walked in, the clerk freaked out. It was comedic. I mean, he stumbled around like he was trying to grab the phone or something, and he looked at us with his eyes bulging out of their sockets. Seriously, we didn't pay him any mind. We just went to the back of the store where the beer was until several minutes later when we heard the door open. And standing in the doorway was a tall deputy wearing these reflective aviator glasses. Now, I'm a child of the 80s, and when I saw him, the first thing that came to mind was Roscoe P. Coltrane from the TV show Dukes of Hazzard. I know it's so stereotypical, but I'm being honest, that's what I thought. And it didn't help when he spoke. Side note, I'm from the South, and I can speak the dialect with the best of them. Personally, I think it's beautiful and has no bearing on a person's intelligence. So don't get it twisted, but when the police officer with reflective glasses approached us, his accent was so thick that all I could hear was,
boy.
I wasn't sure what he said, but I knew the period well. Boy. Now, I'm a grown man at this time, but I'm also from the South, and I know what can happen to young black men with big mouths facing authority. So I shut up. But the people with me didn't. They were mad and started arguing.
Come on, man. Like, we just came in here to get some beer. We're not doing anything.
Oh, my God. Like, I'm going to call somebody.
Yo, why are you looking at us like that? The cop didn't respond. He just watched them through his reflective glasses, and I could feel the tension in the room. So when the poets were done hollering at the cop, I figured that I would be the voice of reason. Sir, we're not doing anything. We just came in to get some beer and go back to the hotel. We're poets. We're in town for the Southern Fried Poetry Slam. It's happening downtown tomorrow night. You should come check it out. It's going to be great. And with all of his attention on me, he said,
Summer poetry slam. Boy, fighting chickens in this county is illegal.
And everyone got silent. Just like you right now, thinking, what? And then it struck me. No, sir, not a poultry slam. A poetry slam, a poetry slam. Poets, poems, competing against each other. Not chicken.
Oh. Huh. I ain't never been to no poetry slam before, but I done seen them fighting to them chickens, and that's illegal. I guess y'all can go on then, but I'ma keep an eye on you.
And with that, he walked back to the counter and watched us as we finished the beer run and walked back to the hotel. And when we got there, we told the story to everyone, and they laughed so hard, and we went right back to partying. It was a good night. The next day, it was poetry slam time in downtown Americus, Georgia, and Americus came out. You couldn't find a seat. I was shocked that so many people came. It was a great event. The place was overflowing, a lot of good poems and poets and community. And at the end of the night, you know, I walked outside alone just to catch my breath and to breathe it all in. The sun was going down, the street was lined with trees, and it was just beautiful. And I heard someone walking towards me, and when I turned around, it was him, the cop. And even in the dusk, he was still wearing those reflective glasses. And he came up to me, and he said,
I really liked your poem. It was a tad bit better than watching them chickens.
And with that, he dipped his hat and walked into the night. Now, I have no delusions that the poems changed his world view, but for 1 minute, he and I were in this equal place. Sometimes in life, man, that's just got to be good enough. And it was then, at that moment, that I thought, you know, poetry, it can change the world.
So I come from a long line of bartenders, sweat breakers, broken backs from digging ditches, and a handful of teachers. You see, my ma taught math, my sis teaches English, and dad told us stories. Now all of this spins around in my mind, and I see it spinning faster and faster in the reflection of the eyes of the student whose face is only inches from mine as he says, what are you going to do about it if I don't? All pufferfish pointy-chested as the rest of the high school class waits. Waits as the ink beneath my long sleeves buttoned up in slacks begins to burn. Waits as my first mosh pit branded brain begins to boil. Waits as I keep back all the gasoline bile and get all choked up on the hand grenade pins and needles that have been planted in my throat and grown a drum set in my jawbone that I play in time with swaying picket signs like a... But today, I muted it.
Honestly, I want to tell this kid I'm proud of him. I'm glad. I'm glad that after 13 years of learning, the one thing he has not picked up on is to blindly follow authority. I want to tell him this. I want to tell him I'm sorry. I'm sorry you're stuck in a broken system where men in designer suits who had never even seen a classroom keep cutting art out of the heart of education because you can't properly or profitably express yourself with enough to color by letters, number two pencil, piss poor, pointless, and painting like A, B, C, or D. All of the above is being held above all else. I want to tell him this. I want to tell him I'm sorry, but it just comes out as, sit down, kid. Sit down. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Sit down. Save your strength. Hold on to that crumpled paper homemade bomb heart that keeps blasting shards of chicken scratch shrapnel through your bloodstream. Hold on to it like sandbags for a really rainy day. I know it hurts right now for you because it still does for me too. But there is a difference between picking a fight and picking your fights. This one's not worth it. I'm temporary, man. I'm gone from your life by the end of this period. Then I'm off to who knows where to substitute all of their authority and none of the time. All of their authority, none of the mutual respect. All of their authority, none of the chances to really make you listen. So listen now. Sit down. A cop is not going to be so polite, kid. They'll give you nothing less than a slap on the jaw with a nightstick. So sit down. There's something to be said for political captives when there's not a whole lot of valor in a detention slip. So sit down. Sit down and stand up for something worth it. Stand up and stand strong for something worth it. But for now, sit down. I'm sorry. I'm tired. I spent all of yesterday in a gang graffiti-soaked in-school suspension classroom breaking up fights and squared off with a seventh-grade girl with more balls than either of us would know what to do with and a blade in her backpack for the walk home. This tough guy ain't gonna work on me. I mean, for Christ's sake, you're wearing 3D glasses with the lenses popped out right now. How am I supposed to take you seriously? But seriously, you might not get this, and you might just think I'm another asshole with a name tag who's telling you what to do, but I swear from the bottom of the bricks and spray paint in my belly that when I am saying sit down, I am praying you learn what it means to stand up.
That was Kevin Burke, a slam poet from Austin, Texas. You can check him out at kevinwburkepoetry.com. We got a lot more poems and poets coming up on State of the Reunion's Poetry Special.
Maybe you start your day with the news on Morning Edition
and catch up later with All Things Considered.
But the news continues during the day in courtrooms, financial markets, on the streets, and at kitchen tables.
Locally, nationally, around the world.
Each afternoon, check in with Here and Now for the news as it's happening.
That's Here and Now from WBUR and NPR News.
Weekdays starting at noon on AM 580.
WILL programming is made possible by the University of Illinois School of Music, presenting the Allerton Music Barn Festival, Thursday, September 18th through Sunday, September 21st at Allerton Park. More information is at allertonmusicbarn.com.
I'm Al Letson, and you are listening to State of the Reunion's Poetry Month Special.
Things my father gave me, which I never asked for. Life, a home plate, a backyard with a pitching mound, a split-finger fastball, a slider, a curve, how to break in a glove, when to slide head first, a family name to uphold, open arms. Time, a huffy bike, how to crack pecans, a sandbox, how to piss, how to be a rock, when to till the earth, how to make a fist, when to fight, when to smile, how to trap a rabbit, how to catch a liar, how to speak when white people are present, how to talk when white folk ain't, the difference between a flathead, a Phillips head, and a hard head, a roof over my head, room to grow, how to shoot a free throw, when to call a foul, how to drive, a high top fade, how to ask out a lady, how to let her be a woman, how to use a level, how to keep your cool, when to be cool, cool, a pimp stroll, how to smoke out wasps, where to get good fish, funk and wagnalls, when to ask for help, when to give it, how to speak up, a love of brown, Tarleton, how to mow the lawn, to hammer, to saw, how to change a tire, when to change the oil, how to handle change, how to tie a tie, how to buy a suit, how to earn an honest dollar, how to lead, how to follow, how to read the spread, when to swallow your pride, how to raise a fence, how to use a knife for a pencil sharpener, when to shoot a gun, how to shake a man's hand, how to look him in the eye, a thirst to learn, a bookcase, muscadines, nights to dream, dream books, reasons to cry, dark skin, strong teeth, full lips, blood, two brothers, how to care for elders, how to honor them, how to admit when you're wrong, how to apologize before the funeral, how to love, yes, and how to always, always, always come home.
That poem was by Ayodele Heath, a good friend of mine and poet from Atlanta, Georgia. Ayo, as I call him, is one of my favorite poets. He's an author of one book and an editor of another and a spellbinding performer. I caught up with him to talk a little bit about the craft.
You know, without dating myself, I've probably been performing poetry as long as I have not been performing poetry. So I'm about half and half in my years here, I guess.
Yeah, so you've been in Atlanta your whole life. How'd you get into poetry? Like, what was the attraction?
Well, it's an interesting story, kind of secondhand. I was a high school student. I thought poetry was actually kind of corny. And one day, an administrator took a couple of students, kind of unbeknownst to parents and teachers and whatnot, during lunch to a Maya Angelou performance. So just kind of snuck out for an hour and came back. I'm sure broke all sorts of administrative laws or whatever. And anyway, the two students who went were friends of mine, and they came back, and like their eyes were like the size of moons. And then they were going on and on about Maya Angelou and how she was doing her poems. And these weren't even people who were into poetry, and they were just like, you know, she was expressive, she was crying, and her body was moving. And it was just like this electric description of what Maya Angelou had done. And I guess it must have kind of stuck with me. And then as a freshman at Georgia Tech, I was looking for something kind of easy to squeeze, you know, in a couple of hour spot. And there was an intro to poetry workshop that was being offered, and you had to submit this packet in order to get accepted into the class. And so I submitted a packet. I had never really seriously written before, but I had a couple of poems. And anyway, I got chosen for the class. I was a math and science junkie in high school and early college, but this was just something different. And that really set it off.
That's interesting. I had no idea that you were a math and science guy.
Math originally spoke to me like a language. And so, you know, when I got to studying poetry in high school, it kind of had a similar effect on me, that sort of cryptic, there's something being spoken here that's deep and resonating about the universe, even though I don't quite understand it at the moment. But I know that if I try hard enough, I can unlock it, and like it'll open me up to the world. So that math and poetry have spoken to me in the same ways. Inhaling, sharp, cold, metallic, abandonment. They've closed Woodruff Park, where last summer, Brother Johnson in a striped bow tie, one of the brothers from the Nation, gave him at the shelter back in 87.
A lot of the stuff that you write about, you know, there's a side of it that is kind of personal. Like, I think the poem about your father is definitely personal. But then there's the more political side where you're talking about things like, you know, Woodruff Park.
Sure. So my belief is not an original thought, is that the personal is political. Right. And so, you know, I definitely believe that we're all given gifts. I mean, to some extent, you know, we work on our craft, but there's part of this that I did not earn. It is not mine. And therefore, because I did not earn it and it is not mine, it is on loan to me, this thing I do with words and delivery. And so I have a responsibility to whom I received it from.
The type of poets that I love, the type of poets that engage me, because I because I come from a tradition of oral storytelling and oral histories and that sort of thing. I love hearing poetry out loud. I also love reading it. But I think that what has happened, what the effect of the slam has been on a lot of poets who have moved out of the slam, is that the slam makes you respect the audience in a way that I think maybe academic poets don't necessarily think about.
I started a slam here, I believe, in 99 or 2000. Started the event from scratch. I fought to get those audiences to come through the door. And so fighting for those audiences, not for myself, but for other poets who would perform for them at the events that I would host, the audiences meant everything. I mean, I had to sweat tears, printer paper, ink cartridges to get them to come in the door. You best believe I respect audiences. I wonder if black turns to blue when you're that cold, old, low, and forgotten by this progressive city of lofty glass skyscrapers full of stone throwers who've never walked a mile, even in their own shoes.
One thing strikes me, you didn't tell us what your name means.
Yep, so I received that name in 99 from a Yoruba priest. And the name Ayodele means a joy comes into the house. I learned when the name was given to me that it's often given to the firstborn in a family in the Yoruba culture.
Well, I have to say that every time I've seen you on stage, you have brought joy to the house.
Well, thank you very much.
That was Ayodele Heath, a poet from Atlanta, Georgia. You can find more about him at his website, IOSpeaks. That's AYOSpeaks.com. You can also go to our website, stateoftheunion.com, for links to his work, including the new digital anthology, Electric Corpse.
This first poem is called Debbie, from I Love You Is Back. Attached to a little red plane, a sky banner floats above. It says, Debbie, do you love me? Not Debbie, I love you. Not Debbie, will you marry me? But Debbie, do you love me? It detached from the back of the little red plane, the sky banner wisping down. I wondered who it would land on. I imagined that person having a hell of a day, if their name happens to also be Debbie. I could see it making her believe in God. The next poem is called Eating the Hole. It's about chatting with people on the road. I asked the man about the greatest feeling he could remember. He talked about a time when he worked at a sandwich shop in Amarillo, Texas, and had to make the condiments, and on Fridays after work, he would fill a surgical glove with guacamole and slide his hand in it when no one was looking, opening and closing his fist through the green thickness. As he did this, he made an ooh sound, opening and closing his hand, looking into my eyes. I asked him if he ever got lonely. He said, never.
That was poet and publisher Derek Brown. You can check him out at brownpoetry.com. Derek runs Right Bloody Publishing. He's got an amazing stable of writers, including Kristen O'Keefe Aptowitz. Kristen is legendary in the New York City slam community, not just for her work on stage, but as a writer and an organizer. And my God, this woman can write. She's got a new book out on Right Bloody titled The Year of No Mistakes. I loved that title so much that I had to know the story behind it.
Hi, my name is Kristen O'Keefe Aptowitz. My mother really instilled in me a lifelong love of reading and writing. And so from a very early age, I knew I wanted to be a writer. And one of the things I knew growing up in working class Philadelphia was that I had to leave my neighborhood to be a writer. And I had to go to New York City, which it seemed to be where writers lived. So as soon as I could, I graduated Central High School in Philadelphia and went to NYU to study writing. Experiences at NYU were very sort of difficult. I was paying my own way through college, and a lot of the other kids didn't have to have that concern. I was always trying to be the best writer in the class. I'm one of those personalities. And I really found enormous competition with a fellow NYU student named Bo Sia. Bo Sia was a senior, and I was a sophomore, and he and I had totally opposite visions of how to be a writer. I was very dedicated, did draft after draft after draft, you know, tried to be, you know, sat in the front row, was the teacher's pet. And he came in late in Hawaiian shirts and breakaway pants, having just written whatever he was going to be presenting, and it always killed. He was so brilliant and effortless. And at the end of the year, he invited all of the pretty girls in class, and not me, to see him perform in a poetry slam. And I, of course, took that as a challenge and showed up at the poetry slam, which was happening in the West Village at that time.
If there's anyone in the entertainment industry watching me perform, I want you to keep in mind that regardless how you feel about the content or performance of my work, that if you're casting any films and you need a Korean grocery store owner, a computer expert, or the random thug of a Yakuza gang, that I'm your man!
And I was absolutely addicted from jump one and began performing, slamming myself the following week.
Now, coming to the stage, Kristen O'Keefe afterwards.
It was the first time that I'd ever experienced anything like it. When I was a kid and dreamed about what it would be like to be a writer in New York City, I was dreaming of what the Poetry Slam was. It was this incredibly diverse and passionate group of people all getting up and telling their own story in their own words.
It was just Mom and me, a stack of books, and NPR coming through the radio like the voice of God.
It's a Friday night at 10 p.m. in the greatest city in the world.
I'm writing the poem that'll change the world, and it's Lily Wilson at my office door.
And you have like 300 people sitting on the floor.
It's a living thing! It's a living thing with more...
packed into rafters, all focusing their energy on one person.
Through meditation, I program my heart to beat breakbeats and hum bass lines on exhalation.
I got this amazing opportunity to follow this dream of being a writer who could focus just on her writing and not additionally working a day job, which has always been the way I live my life. So I left New York City, which had been my home for 14 years. The last night we spent in NYC as actual New Yorkers, we spent inside of you. Everyone was there. The hustlers, the poets, the boss. But because of those opportunities, because I had to leave New York City, it had a real detrimental effect on my relationship. I had dated Shappy C. Schultz, the host of the Urbana Slam, for 11 really happy years. And as soon as we left New York City, it really began to fall apart. Sometimes I fall into its arms to cry a bit. It seems silly to cry alone. The Year of No Mistakes is sort of a chronicle of the aftermath of the breakup of this very long-term relationship. To end doesn't mean something is a failure. A character in a movie once told me, everyone ceases to exist. It doesn't mean everyone's a failure. And I tell this to people all the time to explain us. The Year of No Mistakes, the title, references a talk that Anis Mojgani, who's another incredible poet, gave, where he talked about how every year he and his friends named the year so that you knew what the year was going to be about, and that the year that I went through this breakup, he had named the Year of No Mistakes, which does not mean that you can't make mistakes, but more that anything that happened to you wasn't a mistake. It was an opportunity for you to learn more about yourself and challenge yourself. And so that became sort of my anthem for the year. And it really helped me as I went through this breakup. And so it became, obviously, the title of the book. New York City feels like a dream now, you once told me. And I understood exactly what you meant. I made sure to show him all of the poems that were about him in the book.
so that he could veto them if he felt uncomfortable. We've stayed really close friends, so that wasn't a difficult part of the process, but I still wanted him to feel like he had control over it. And strangely enough, his job here in Austin is as a bookseller. He's in the receiving department. So there was this one awful day where he opened up a box and there was multiple copies of the book about his breakup, and the guy knew, his coworker knew that this day was happening, and came over and put his hand on Chappie's shoulder and said, "Hey, you know what? This is kind of like a dream come true for you." And Chappie was like, "What do you mean?" And he's like, "Well, you've said you wanted to be in a Woody Allen movie. This is pretty much a Woody Allen movie." And it's true. "Yesterday, I was given a photo of us in our first year. My hand on your cheek, your happy paw on my waist. We didn't know the picture was being taken. Our faces were two bright suns shining only for each other. My God, I couldn't help but think, I wonder if I will ever be in love like that." You know, we still love each other like crazy, but like the Woody Allen movie Annie Hall, some people can love each other like crazy but just are not meant to be with each other forever. And I'm just happy that we realized that and could still be friends instead of letting it tear us apart.
You can check out more of Kristen's work at aptowitz.com. Also, check out our publisher, Write Bloody. That's writebloody.com. We will be right back with more poems and poets when State of the Reunion's poetry special continues. Support for State of the Reunion comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, a growing network of listeners, producers, and stations collaborating to make public radio more public. PRX.org.
Composer, bandleader, and musician Gerald Wilson died Monday at the age of 96. On the next Fresh Air, we listen back to our 2006 interview with him. Also, A. Scott Berg tells us why President Woodrow Wilson remains a divisive figure even though he left the White House in 1921. Berg's biography of Wilson is out in paperback. Join us.
Weekday mornings at 11 and again at 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Support comes from the Center for Advanced Study with a CAS initiative lecture, Natural Hazards and Human Behavior, The Dynamics of Mega Disasters, by Susan Kiefer, Professor Emerita of Geology and Physics, Wednesday, September 17th at 7:30 p.m. in Knight Auditorium at Spurlock Museum.
I'm Al Letson, and you are listening to State of the Reunion's Poetry Special. It's that time of the year when spring is just getting started. The birds are out, the snow is finally going away, for those of you crazy enough to live places where it snows. No judgment, just saying, not I. And it's Poetry Month, one of my favorite times of the year. This whole hour is dedicated to celebrating poems and poets, and maybe for some of you, opening your mind to everything that poetry can be. Like this.
If I was the center of everything for a day, everything would be aimed towards, dictated by, catered to, tailored for, 5'2" tattooed Asian females. When you turned on the television, no Martha Stewart, Tom Brokaw, Katie Couric, or Stephen Colbert. Just 5'2" tattooed Asian females giving makeup tips for the Asian eye. Instructions on how to raise children multilingually in America. Advertisements for custom designed builders who retrofit houses for the fabulously petite. News that tells of the latest community organizing campaigns and where the hottest DJ set is for that night. Everything catered to me. All of the movies would tell the stories of wayward, liberated, activist, brainiac single girls and our pot dealer MC boyfriends, healing wounds with family members overseas while fighting for fair wages for factory workers around the world, which would be easy. Since all of the governments would be run
by 5'2" tattooed Asian females. We'd wave to the cameras enthusiastically, give out free sandwiches to the entire world every Wednesday. We'd match our lip gloss to our fair trade boots and throw a dance party every time we signed a truly revolutionary bill. And I'd get to ask people dumb questions all day. 'Cause isn't everybody a 5'2" tattooed Asian female? And isn't it so great to be us? But you know what? I might let you, non-5'2", non-tattooed, non-Asian, non-females, I might let you keep your languages. I might even give you equal access to education and healthcare too. I might even share the airwaves and our houses of government, give you a shot at working your way up in our financial institutions, because I know that there is no you without me. And from the only to the other, I know there's no me without you.
That poem was entitled Self-Centered, and it was by the great Kelly Zen-Yi Tsai. You can see more of her work on her website at yellowgirl.com. That's yellow, G-U-R-L.com. She has a really cool 360-degree video for the poem. You can see that at our website, stateoftheunion.com. So when I got into poetry and started performing across the country, one of the things I got hooked into was a youth poetry slam. Adult poets go in and mentor young people, and I got to see firsthand how the program and facilitators help kids find their voice and make a change in these young people's lives and also in their communities. This is the story of one of those programs.
My name is James Cass. I am the founder and executive director of Youth Speaks. Well, I was pursuing my MFA in creative writing at San Francisco State and working at KQED, and I had been a teacher beforehand. And at that time in California, I was noticing two distinct trends that were pretty upsetting to me. One was, in the media, young people were being misrepresented in multiple ways. Some propositions were on the ballot and in the air in California that were specifically targeting young people of color, I thought. And they didn't have any chance to speak publicly. And then on the other flip, while I was getting my degree in writing in a very diverse cosmopolitan area, the MFA program lacked really any diversity at all. But the poetry slam scene, which I did my first of in 1996, was really rich with diversity. So I wanted to sort of marry the opportunity to give young people, you know, real professional support and development in their own writing and performance, but do it in a way that was accepting of them and celebratory of them and vibrant and alive.
I don't see color.
Oh my God, I didn't even know you were black until just now.
What you meant to say was, oh, I'm choosing to deny your personal identity inherited in order to make me feel more comfortable.
So, you know, I started the organization by first going out to the public high schools in San Francisco and bringing a few of my performance poet friends. And we would go do a few poetry assemblies and some writing workshops. We got a bunch of donated computers in the early days of the dot-com world in the Bay Area and invited kids to come out to after-school writing workshops. And if they put in 40 hours of writing workshops, they would get a computer to take home. And then that led to planning for the first Youth Speaks Teen Poetry Slam in April of 1997, where about 150 kids showed up totally unexpectedly, and we sold out the theater 2 weeks in a row. And that was the beginning of Youth Speaks.
Stripped of all her color,
when I am left clutching out for the last mirage of a broken land, I cannot fall. I will not fall.
I remember distinctly at the first poetry slam that we did with young people, there was a kid who was really polished on stage, and it was like a really sharp performance, and the audience, who was new to this, really liked it. But then the next kid came up and was shaking, the paper was shaking, was real nervous, but was telling something that was obviously really true and really meaningful to the poet. And the audience didn't like it as much, but the kids loved it, and they all rushed to that kid and hugged him. And that was when I really saw, you know, young people are doing something very different in their work. They're really bringing their own lives into the poetry. They're not showing off as much as they're sort of showing themselves.
To the father who saved me, when mama told me the story of when she wanted to abort me, I felt your voice grasp like a boa constrictor. I'm sure your arms felt like Titanic life jackets that day. When I was a watermelon seed.
Yeah, so after we started doing our work, I started reaching out to different people across the country and finding out what was happening with teenagers and sort of new movement in poetry, and there were a handful of folks getting started. We started working together to launch the first National Youth Poetry Slam, which became Brave New Voices, and from that moment on, it really took off.
This is the Brave New Voices National Teen Poetry Slam Championship, also known as BNV.
The next generation can clearly speak for itself.
They represent teens from all over the country.
Give it up! Give it up! Give it up!
And the journeys began months early.
Well, you know, oftentimes when a young person first shows up, they're looking for one of two things. They're looking for a place to be accepted and a place to be heard, but I think they're also looking for a place to be challenged and to be mentored. So young people typically come in and they come multiple ways. They sign up for the poetry slam or an open mic, or they come to one of our after school workshops, or we meet them in a high school. And you know, they either have already been writing or they've never really written anything but are interested in it. But the where they start off is nowhere near where they develop into. Like at first they're really in this place of trying to find their voice and find themselves, and over time and through support of their mentors and their peers, they really begin to find out what's unique about them and how they can tell their own story, and only the story that they can tell.
We have labeled human as a medical condition.
Locking people in pharmaceutical cages.
Medication as preemptive strikes.
We are building the perfect army.
Hazy children become brain-dead
teenagers become easily controlled adults.
I wake up 14 years old and my tongue is a corpse, like I chase the pills with shots of formaldehyde.
Several years ago, this incredible young writer named Katri Foster had the opportunity to perform at this major environmental event. She was, you know, Bill Clinton and Bishop Desmond Tutu were going to follow her. She was going to speak in front of 10,000 leading scientists and public health advocates and housing advocates.
I've heard that these things happen. Sometimes it's hot, water dries. Snow melts, animals die, and my brother has a brain tumor.
And then she wrote about the coincidence of living half a mile from the Chevron oil refinery and living right on the polluted bay, and her family growing up, you know, without money, so needing to feed, you know, a heavy chemical diet to the kids. And she just really broke down all of the different things that weigh down negatively in the environment on a kid's lives.
The doctor said that the kind of tumor my brother had has a 1 in 2 million chance of occurring in a lifetime. My brother was 10.
And it completely changed the conversation for the rest of the day at this international conference by environmental leaders. So there's that. There's, you know, the using of the voice to make as a tool. But then we see other young people who get involved and they learn about topics as they write about them, and then that moves them into a place of sort of activism in their professional career. So they, you know, really are writing about immigration or something when they're young, and then 5 years later they're working in the labor immigrant resource center.
And when test scores reflect budget cuts, teachers play hot potato with the kids that can't read, just send them to the basement. Special education is the new segregation, while standardized tests are the sequel to separate but equal.
Teachers don't often have the opportunity, largely because of all the pressures they have in the classroom, to actually really get to know the students in meaningful ways. And I can't tell you how many teachers have come up to us after one of our performances to remark on a poem that one of their students did, and that student hadn't said a word all semester in their class or is failing their English class, but said something incredibly smart on stage. So there really is that kind of disconnect that happens. Now, you know, it fluctuates what the kids talk about. You know, they are teenagers, so there are definitely some standard teenage angsty stuff, but a lot of it is really about, you know, who am I in this world that I live in, and how do I impact this world, and how does the world impact me?
Restlessly propelled bus tour through poverty's playpen. Inhaling. Vile stench of minimum wage and food stamps. Unholy concoction of $8 an hour. A $960 cramped studio apartment fed by CalFresh's moldy government cheese. You can't see a reflection in dark waters.
There are two comments that adults who for the first time come to a You Speak show say almost consistently. One is, I wasn't speaking about anything nearly as comprehensive or smart or intelligent when I was 16 as these kids are now. And two, I'm leaving tonight more hopeful for the future than I was when I came in.
In the United States, we funnel more money into prisons than we do into education. 1.2 million students drop out of school each year. That's one every 26 seconds.
One in three black men will end up in prison.
One in six Hispanic men will end up in a box.
With the push of a button, hundreds of jail cells shut simultaneously.
We're about to launch this project actually with the Corporation for Public Broadcasting called Raise Up, which is young people using the power of spoken word and hip-hop to take on the dropout crisis. And those kinds of opportunities come about because of the visibility the program has gotten. We've done, you know, two seasons on HBO in partnership with Russell Simmons, and we did a documentary on PBS, and we've been covered in media all across the country, the New York Times, the Washington Post, CNN, etc. I think it's, honestly, there are not too many places where young people that really represent the demographic of 21st century America are heard in real and honest ways.
But if you listen closely, you can hear her. She's crying, help me, and I'm banging on the window, help her. And if you listen closely, you can hear Junior crying in the background. His diaper is pissy, but they're pissed poor. She's gotta make 10 Pampers stretch through the week. Trina's a potential savior, but she's living herself to death doing backstrokes to make ends meet.
We work with about 40,000 kids a year alone in the Bay Area because we're in over 50 public high schools every single year. We think that through our combination of all of our programs, we're working with about 250,000 kids a year, every year across the United States. So it's a lot of young people who are being touched by it. You know, some young people go in deeper than others, but you know, it's safe to say that 250,000 young people, one way or the other, are writing poems and performing poems all across the United States every single year.
The women broken into before my birth never healed. My Nana chokes her sorrows with tobacco. Mama douses hers with Hennessy. Victims of self.
The very first high school we went to was George Washington High School in San Francisco. And I remember specifically asking this group of about 100 kids, how many of you write poetry or know anybody who writes poetry? And two kids sort of shyly raised their hands and then put them quickly back down. So last year I observed a school visit, because I don't do them anymore, but I observed a school visit at George Washington High School 17 years later. And in the exact same room with about 100 kids, they said, how many of you write poetry? And half the room shot their hands up aggressively. How many of you know somebody writes poetry? Everybody in the room. You know, teachers 15 years ago were like, teaching poetry is the worst, kids hate it. Now they can't wait till we get into their school to work with them. Young people have really defined or redefined what poetry can mean, and they've breathed a whole new life into their art form. And now young people are growing up where poetry is like a cool thing. It's like, I've watched poetry my entire life. Now I'm a teenager and I want to be a poet too. It's really been a true paradigm shift in what young people think poetry can be. And I think in some ways, some of the greatest work Youth Speaks has done has been to give kids permission to redefine not only poetry, but redefine themselves in the public sphere.
That was James Kaz, founder and executive director of Youth Speaks. You also heard a lot of youth poets from all over the country. Now, chances are there is a youth poetry program in your neck of the woods. So if you like what you heard, you can go check it out live. Just go to youthspeaks.org and you can find some resources there that can connect you in your community. I told someone once that I write poetry. And their response was, why poetry? I mean, what does it matter? No one buys poetry books. People don't care. The average American probably couldn't name five poets, so why bother with it? And at the time, I couldn't help but think of one of my all-time favorite movies.
We live in a cynical world. A cynical world.
That is from Jerry Maguire. Oh, spare me. You know when you saw that scene for the first time, you felt a lump in your throat. You know you did. Mm-hmm. Okay. Anyway, it's true. We do live in a cynical world, in hard times. We are saturated with media and political arguments and social interactions that are all about connecting but not connection. Words have been manipulated to sell you something, to make you believe in things that are not true. And it's so easy to get lost in all of it. And sometimes we need to be reminded of what it means to be a human being, to appreciate the beauty around you, to focus on the loss or injustice of someone else, to bear witness when a poet speaks their truth. And when we do this together, in community, or alone with a book, we celebrate our flawed humanity, and there is power in that. Why do I love poetry? 'Cause words matter, and poems and poets help us remember that.
In the beginning.
That poetry began when somebody walked off a savanna or out of a cave and looked up at the sky with wonder and said, ah. And that was the first poem.
Praise your voice and the ears that listen to you.
When you name your daughter, it's a prayer for everything you want her to be. It makes sense then that she named me nothing.
Praise the mornings, for we woke another day.
There is hurt here that cannot be fixed by band-aids or poetry.
Praise Neruda, Lorca, Baraka, Ginsberg, and Pietri.
But I know the differences words can make. It is a gift my mother gave me.
Praise today, for it's the most beautiful day. Thank you.
When Words Matter was produced by me, Al Ledson, with help from senior editor Taki Telenidis. The rest of the So True staff is Tina Antolini, Delaney Hall, Laura Starcheski, and business manager Bree Burge. Special thanks to Mark Williams, the Center for Investigative Reporting, Mike Henry, and Paul Devlin. You can hear more poets and see some of their performances at State of the